I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one looks for what is shaking the American empire of consumption with an unorthodox military man and university teacher, Andrew Bacevich. He struck a chord with a best-selling diagnosis of a country that got hooked on deficits, debt, and war as permanent conditions of life, where he says the sky now goes dark with chickens coming home to roost. Andy Bacevich is a West Point graduate, an Army veteran of Vietnam and Desert Storm, a conservative Catholic whose son and namesake was killed on Army duty in Iraq. Bacevich's compact book of lessons for our time is called The Limits of Power. In his subtitle, he picks up the theme of a lot of open source conversations around what has always made the U.S. different in the world. His phrase is the end of American exceptionalism. We talked in Andy Bacevich's office at Boston University, where he teaches history and international relations. Andy Bacevich, everybody's looking for a general view of what in the world we're going through, militarily in the Middle East, economically on Wall Street, culturally on our TV sets. And you've taken as brave a stab at it as anybody I know in this book, The Limits of Power. Give us the Bacevich synthesis, and then we'll take it apart.
Well, I think that the very core of the argument that I'm offering is one that says that the biggest problems that beset us are not out there. The biggest problems that beset us are in here, that we have lived beyond our means for too long a period of time. We have come to rely excessively on military force to try to sustain this problem, and that it's not working. So it's time to wake up. It's time to look at ourselves in the mirror. It's time to clean up our act. It's time to set our own house in order and have that take priority over trying to set the world's house in order.
You're a military man, and the main critique here, I suppose, is of the Pentagon and the war in Iraq. Take that apart in particular.
Well, I must say I don't think of myself in particular as a military man any longer. It's been 16 years since I left the Army. I was in the Army for 23 years before that. I frankly have thought, I think, much more about war and war's relation to politics and the proper role of force in international politics. I've thought about those things much more in the last 16 years than I did during the 23 years when I was in the Army. And I think the conclusion that I've come to, and this is a conclusion that has very much been reinforced by the events of the past 7 years, is, I think, 2 points. One would be that American military power is far more limited than most observers imagined or calculated back around 2000 or 2001. And the utility of force is simply much more limited than many Americans in the political elite came to believe after the Cold War. I argue in this book, I actually have argued in my previous book on militarism, that after the end of the Cold War, too many of us became infatuated with military power and came to believe that our possession and our willingness and our capacity to use military power really had given the United States a particularly effective instrument, a tool to fix problems. And that was an illusion.
There's a ripping anger in this book about the Pentagon, about Tommy Franks, Douglas Feith, Donald Rumsfeld. You talk about a kind of unspeakable gap in generalship in the modern American military. You also talk about a complete abolition of nuclear weapons. Give us a taste of that.
Well, I admire people who serve in uniform, who serve the country, and I think that you don't need to hear it from me that our soldiers have performed valiantly in Iraq and Afghanistan, because they really have. Set that aside. It also seems very clear to me in Iraq and Afghanistan and in earlier conflicts going back at least as far as Operation Desert Storm, that the senior leadership of the Pentagon, whether we're talking the civilian leadership or the military leadership, has been sketchy at best and has been at times completely and competent. And notwithstanding all the rhetoric about supporting the troops, we should be willing to examine critically the performance of these people in high office, people to whom we have entrusted great responsibility. When they screw up, we got to call a spade, and we should, as a nation, ask very serious questions about why incompetent people are entrusted with positions of great responsibility.
You write about war as a permanent condition of American policy, American thinking, American practice since 9/11. How did that happen?
Well, I mean, the first thing, I think the most important thing to recognize, and it's something I think that ought to make people's heads snap back, is that what people in the Pentagon now call the long war, some people refer to as generational war, is an expectation that the global war on terror is really going to go on indefinitely. Regardless of what may happen tomorrow or 6 months from now in Iraq, the larger conflict is an open-ended one that will not end any time in the foreseeable future. So this has become the expectation of people who work in the national security business that, for all practical purposes, war has become a permanent condition. How'd that come about? Well, I think it came about two explanations or two factors here. One is the enormous confidence in military power that policy elites developed after the Cold War. And Donald Rumsfeld here really is, I think, an emblematic figure, somebody who came to office before 9/11 now, came to office, I think, seized by the conviction that we had begun to develop a new American way of war based on information technology that held the promise of permanent dominance, supremacy, global hegemony, and viewed that as an opportunity that really needed to be pursued aggressively. Before 9/11, Rumsfeld's big fights were with the armed services, in particular the Army, because as far as he was concerned, armies were largely becoming obsolete. They were not high-tech. And the Army was kind of dragging its feet in preventing this great transformation that he wanted to bring about. So why the long war? Explanation number one is this exalted expectation of what American military power could do. The second explanation, I think, has to do with the way the Bush administration perceived the threat and defined the strategic response to the threat. Now, I myself do not, for a second, dismiss the threat of violent Islamic radicalism. It's real. 9/11 happened. But I don't really see the threat as an existential one. I see it as akin to an international criminal conspiracy. We need to root out this conspiracy and destroy it. You don't do that by invading and occupying countries. But that's not the way the Bush administration defined the threat after 9/11. They saw the terrorists as representative of a major political movement, an effort to seize control of the Islamic world and to establish some kind of a new caliphate that they referred to, so that all of that part of the world, from Morocco to Indonesia, would be in hostile hands. And they set about trying to prevent that eventuality by changing, transforming, pacifying the Islamic world. The expectation they had was that the invasion of Iraq was going to jumpstart this process, was going to demonstrate that it was feasible, but that really the project of transformation was something that was going to go on for a long, long time. It's not that that we would use military power to sort of invade countries in some kind of a sequential process, but by demonstrating that we possess this power, by demonstrating our will to use it, by demonstrating our capacity to change one country like Iraq, they believed we would be in a position to prevail in this very long project of transformation. Well, what turned out, of course, is we know that our military power didn't exactly produce a decisive, clean, economical victory in Iraq, and it certainly hasn't produced this kind of political transformation. So the prospect of endless struggle beckons, even though, in my judgment, the strategy designed for that endless struggle has definitively failed.
And now the reckoning is upon us. Make the connections that you see between complete reversal of fortunes on the battlefield in the Middle East, in Wall Street, in our culture, in our politics. Where the hell are we?
Well, I think reckoning is the term to use here. I mean, the old saying, the skies grow dark with chickens coming home to roost. Mm. We have conducted ourselves. The American way of life has evolved in a way that we have become ever more dependent upon other countries. We're dependent upon them for our energy. Increasingly, we have become dependent upon them for credit. The books don't balance. I mean, we've had a negative trade balance going back to, I think, roughly 1971, 1972. For the most part, it just gets worse from one day to the next. The federal budget never balances. I mean, one could say, God bless Bill Clinton, that he balanced it once or twice. But for all practical purposes, we live in an era in which federal budget deficits, I believe, are a permanent fact of life, barring any significant change in the way that we do business. So we have allowed ourselves to become more dependent. I think that we persuaded ourselves that this was a sustainable condition, in part because of the psychology of American exceptionalism. You know, we're special. The rules that apply to others don't apply to us. And in part, I think, because we thought that military power was our trump card. And it isn't. I mean, I know that there are people who argue that we're on the verge of victory in Iraq, that things have turned around there. I certainly agree that things are better there today than they were a year or 18 months ago, but we're not on the verge of victory. President Bush is going to leave office with something like 135,000 troops still there. We're certainly not on the verge of victory in Afghanistan. And so we find ourselves stuck in these two protracted wars. And again, even if tomorrow Iraq turned out to be a quote-unquote victory, what would we have gained? You know, Iraq is not a template for how to go about changing the rest of the region. I mean, Iraq is a place where we have invested probably somewhere between $800 billion and $1 trillion to date. We've lost over 4,100 American lives, and it's difficult for me to see that what we have gained is anywhere like what we have invested. Well, now, there are those who would say, I guess, we just need to try harder. You know, I mean, where's that old American stick-to-itiveness? And the problem there, of course, is even if you want to try harder, you want to spend more money on defense, there is no more money to spend. Do you want to increase the size of the army? Because if you want to continue this global war on terror, you're going to need a lot bigger army. Where are the soldiers going to come from? The federal government, I believe, has forged a compact with the American people that we rely on volunteers. And in many respects, that system served us extremely well back in the 70s and the 80s and 90s, where our wars were relatively small and relatively infrequent. In the long war, where war is permanent and where the commitments are on a much larger scale, the Army's not big enough. But the federal government has no particular feasible economical way to make it bigger. The draft is impossible. And the American definition of citizenship, of civic responsibility, of service, is one that says, hey, if you want to go join the Army, it's a wonderful thing. But if I don't want to join the Army, then it's not as if that's some kind of represents a moral failure on my part. It is completely a matter of individual choice. So we have too much war, and we have too few warriors.
Andy Bacevich, between the lines of this, I find, remarkable book, The Limits of Power, I sense a personal story. It's partly because I remember 6 years ago being on a panel with you. I'd never met you before. Incoming students at Boston University, September 02. I think it was the very day that the so-called Bush Doctrine was revealed in the New York Times. Unilateral military, we will go basically wherever we choose to straighten out a problem, coalition of the willing, coalition of me, fundamentally. And you and I were talking to the kids about it. I was horrified. I was horrified especially at the kind of cavalier dismissal of Jefferson's, in the Declaration, the decent respect for the opinion of mankind. And my memory of it, I could be wrong, but was that you sort of blew it off and you said essentially to me, get real, the American Empire is here, it's been here a while, and it'll be here after you and I are gone. I sense a huge migration in your thinking since then. I sense, in a wonderful way, a mind in motion here. But tell me about it. What produced this book?
Well, I don't remember what I said to you. And my own recollection, which could be flawed.
Mine too.
Yeah, is that I was always, to understate the case, very skeptical of the Bush doctrine of preventive war. I think I always thought that that was a dumb idea. But I may well have said, there is an American empire, get used to it, because my own evolving, and there's no question about it, evolving thinking about U.S. foreign policy, especially after the Cold War ended, persuaded me that we needed to think in terms of an imperial presence. We needed to see that we were imperial. Not to brag about it, but to recognize the course that we had embarked upon and where it had brought us. If you insist, and many people in my conversations and talks insist this, you know, we're not an empire. You know, we don't have colonies. We're not like Britain. We're not like Rome. In a formal sense, you can make that. You know, we don't have colonies. That's true. But we are an empire in the most fundamental sense in terms of our expectations, the expanse of our influence, the prerogatives that we insist upon. Now, if I said we're an empire, get used to it, I'm guessing that what I meant was we're an empire, and by recognizing that we're an empire, it might be possible for us to manage the empire in ways that the empire will be sustainable, that the empire might at least minimize the moral offenses that it commits, that an empire can be managed in a ways that it's to serve the larger sort of interests and purposes of a variety of peoples. I don't think empires have to be evil and oppressive and stupid. Now, the direction in which my thinking has evolved since that time 6 years ago is I've become persuaded that at least with this administration, that its recklessness, its arrogance, its hubris has been very much at odds with the notion of an empire wisely managed, and the actions of this administration have so squandered American power and influence in the world that they have rapidly accelerated the decline of the American empire. Again, it's not that I'm interested in the empire as such. I am interested in the well-being of the United States of America, and I think that this administration has really done great damage to our well-being.
When I met you, as I say, 6 years ago, I had the sense of you as a person inflamed with anger about what the Clinton administration had done.
And if anybody reads my book, I mean, they will understand clearly that the book is really not an attack on the Bush administration. The book is intended to be a critique of foreign policy, and I try to be quite bipartisan in that critique. I am deeply critical of many aspects of the Clinton administration. I think that the promiscuous use of military power, which we all deplore today, really began in the Clinton administration. I mean, one could actually say it began in the elder Bush, but it really gained momentum in the Clinton administration. Remember, it's Clinton who escalates the military intervention in Somalia. Clinton goes into Haiti. Clinton goes into Bosnia. Clinton goes into Kosovo. Clinton cruise missile attacks in Afghanistan. Clinton bombing the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan. Clinton multiple military confrontations with Saddam Hussein. Now, in the relatively small scale, one could say that the amount of harm they do in terms of lives lost or billions poured down the drain is fairly limited, but I think that Clinton was the president who made the use of military force routine and therefore helped to create this atmosphere in which it became easy to believe that the sensible response to 9/11 was to embark upon a great military enterprise, and I think that was going down exactly the wrong path. So I think Clinton bears his own responsibility for some of our problem.
I'd like you to talk about this matter of American exceptionalism. I've had a lot of conversations with people around this subject, which is part of the subtitle of your book. It's a deeply interesting subject. What makes us different? What makes us peculiar? What makes us important? What makes us, we hate to admit it, vulnerable? How did we get to this point that American exceptionalism meant a military and unilateral role in the world?
Well, I think that I mean, certainly American exceptionalism is a theme that just runs courses through our history. It goes back to the founding of Massachusetts Bay Colony. And so it's always there. It's always part of the mix. It's part of our psychology. It's hardwired, I think, into our beings. I think it's unfortunate that it is, but there it is. I think that the real turning point, though, happened at the end of the Cold War. And I am always struck by the coincidence of events that, on the one hand, 1989, Berlin Wall goes down. This is an event that is read as an American victory, you know, as if we tore the wall down, rather than being read as evidence of an internal collapse of the Soviet Empire, which I believe it actually was. So verdict of history is we've won the Cold War. A year later, less than a year later, Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait, August 1990. And George Herbert Walker Bush mounts this effort to repel the invader, who is portrayed as a Hitler-like figure, again, vastly overstating his significance and his power. But nonetheless, we venture forth in the first major war since Vietnam, and it ends in what seems to be, even though it's not, a world historic victory. And I think it's the coincidence of these two events that suddenly creates this sense of a triumphant America, that the American century has ended in historic victory and now is destined to continue into the future. And remember the language of political discourse at the time, that we were at the end of history, that there was now a single superpower, that we lived in a unipolar moment. These ideas were all swirling around, and what they had in common was this notion of American supremacy. It was as if the old idea of American exceptionalism, of its specialness, of a providential purpose, had now been affirmed in fact. And it was that spirit, I think, carried into the 1990s and beyond 9/11, which provides at least kind of a psychological explanation for why we went down the road we went down.
Not the least of the things that you say are coming to an end in this moment is the nuclear age. You say, and it's in an epilogue, developed only in a few pages, in outline, but you argue that nuclear weapons are completely useless and the United States can't get rid of them, all of them, fast enough. Make that case.
Well, the context of the argument is they're trying to make the case that, I cite Reinhold Niebuhr, who says that the key to success in statecraft is to identify points of concurrence. That is to say, places where your interests overlap with the interests of others. Because Niebuhr argued, and I believe, that all nations act in pursuit of their perceived self-interest. No nation acts on behalf of all mankind, all right? So in order to get things done, you have to recognize where your interests intersect with others. And by way of offering an example of that, I suggested that one of those points of concurrence has to do with nuclear weapons. We don't need them. I mean, they no longer serve any deterrent purpose. Who are we deterring? Osama bin Laden would not be deterred by our possession of nuclear weapons. Rather, we have a very powerful interest in seeking the abolition of that type of weapon. We have a very powerful interest in raising as high as possible the taboo against their further use. We are the only ones who ever used them. So rather than treating the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which we signed, 40 years ago now, where we promised to work for the abolition of nuclear weapons and then discarded that, it's time for us to get serious, make that a priority. And to the extent that we need weapons to defend ourselves, and we do, we can rely on conventional weapons, precision weapons, very accurate weapons. We don't need to rely on weapons that really have no meaningful use in the sense that war is only meaningful when it advances political purposes. That's never going to happen.
Are those weapons useful to India and Pakistan or Israel and Iran? Are they useful to anybody, in your view?
Well, the leaders of those countries may think so, and the fact that we insist upon possessing them, a nuclear arsenal, the fact that we refuse to even to forswear their first use, of course, helps to sort of bolster the argument of Israelis and Indians and Chinese said they need these weapons. Again, the strongest country in the world says, we don't need them. Nobody needs them. These are inappropriate. They're wrong. I think, I'm not trying to be naive here, but I think that could have a powerful political effect in helping to create momentum leading to their complete abolition. Not tomorrow morning, you know, not 6 months from now, but there is no point in us maintaining the nuclear status quo. It just seems to me that it's an argument whose day has come.
Did Reinhold Niebuhr, thinking of the behavior of states, have a notion of how nations withdraw from empire without collapsing? Is there a way out?
Well, I don't know. I don't remember that he ever commented specifically on that. But certainly he wrote, I think with great eloquence and power, that any state, whether an empire or not, needed to see itself the way it really is, needed to see the world as it really is. That mythic notions of your own status, false mythic perceptions of the world, are inevitably going to get you into big trouble, whether you're an empire or not an empire. So his was a council of realism, and I concur in that council.
Andy Bacevich, it's a pleasure to hear you on Open Source. It's been a great pleasure to read this book, The Limits of Power. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
This conversation was produced and edited by Sarah Archambault. Now it's your turn out there to extend the conversation or close the loop with a comment on Limits of Power or American Exceptionalism at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for joining the conversation.